Thank you, Brother Nagarajan. Brother Jerry has chosen title for his discourse, Crossing Jordan. Brother Jerry?
Thank you, Brother Mitchell. Sister Sharon and I are delighted to be in Austin, and we also would like to bring you the love and greetings of our little class in Portland, Oregon. Monthly, they select a text or series of texts for greetings and brethren to consider. And they sent along with us this month John 12, 1 to 8. I'm not going to read all those verses, but it was the occasion when Mary washed and anointed Jesus' feet amid some objection. And Jesus said, "Leave her alone, because she did this for my burying." And so the lesson and encouragement is that we still have this occasion to anoint and wash one another's feet. Our lesson regards faithfulness to our mission and to restoring all, resisting all diversions in these last days. Our text is taken from Joshua, the fourth chapter, verse 10. "For the priests which bear the ark stood in the midst of Jordan until everything was finished, that the Lord commanded Joshua to speak unto the people according to all that Moses commanded Joshua, and the people hastened and passed over." You know, it's estimated that there was a group of 1.5 million to perhaps even 3 million people gathered there. That's larger than the population of Austin, and perhaps double its population. They were ready to enter the promised land. The setting is in the third and the fourth chapters of Joshua, the crossing of Jordan after 40 years in the wilderness. Between the people and their hope flowed a formidable water, the waters of Jordan. Acting under divine orders and after 3 days of waiting, Israel's priests approached the waters of Jordan, bearing the ark on their shoulders, while the mass of the people followed at a distance and beheld one of the great miracles of history. Joshua 3:8-13. "And thou shalt command the priests that bear the ark of the covenant, saying, When ye are come to the brink of the water of Jordan, ye shall stand still in Jordan. And it shall come to pass, as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests that bear the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of Jordan, that the waters of Jordan shall be cut off from the waters that came down from above, and they shall stand up upon a heap." Suddenly, the bed of the river began to dry up, and the people crossed over on foot. The awe-inspiring spectacle was one of the more remarkable, in that it took place at the time when Jordan overflowed all the banks, Joshua 3, verse 15. The priests had carried the ark to the edge of the overflowing waters. Their feet were wet in the water when a landslide cut the flow upstream at a city called Adam, verse 16. Then they entered into the midst of Jordan, some distance from the people, and waited while the nation passed over. Here was enacted one of those sublime dramas on the stage of the typical people of God, which was to furnish some lesson and edification for spiritual Israel. The occasion was that of Joshua leading the Israelites across Jordan after finishing their long and arduous journey across the desert. It is one of the important events in the long course of God's dealing with the sons of men, and is full of typical significance in that it represents the race of man passing out of the curse of the death sentence, the River Jordan, and entering into the blessings of the new earth conditions under the leadership of anatypical Joshua. But within this general allegory, there are other figures of great significance to those who, instead of being represented in the people of Israel at large, are that small and distinct company, the anatypical priests of the gospel age. The affairs of the ancient priesthood are the most intense interest, for they serve to confirm the true purpose and mission of the anatypical priesthood, the true church of Christ. The first and foremost point of interest in this event was the special task assigned to the priests. In advance of the people, they carried the ark into the river and then stood in the midst of Jordan while the whole nation passed over on dry ground, the river having been miraculously dried up to permit their passage. Here again is shown that grand theme of the scriptures, this time in significant type. Christ must first pass into death, Jordan, before the people can pass over. And clearly, this type also teaches a lesson for the under priests. They also must pass into Jordan before any of the people can pass over. It is another picture in confirmation of the composite sin offering that the Christ is part of the sacrificial body. The sacrifice involves a long period of time, nearly 20 centuries. And when the last members of sacrifice is finished, the race of mankind will have left the banks of the old world of sin and death to cross over to the new side, where the new world awaits them. This impressive figure of mighty blessings come to mankind through the ransom sacrifice of Christ and the sin offering of the church participate. It flows all from the sufferings of the sacrificial priesthood, Jesus and the church. For nearly 2,000 years, the priests have been figuratively standing in Jordan. Yet in the symbolic representation, it is as though it all happened together. The sacrifice of the priesthood and the passage of the world of mankind from the present world of death to the new world conditions, thy kingdom come. It is therefore a picture of the atonement doctrine rather than a sequence of events. It is, however, of deep interest to us that the incident is recorded as having occurred at the time of harvest. For now, in the closing hours of the gospel age harvest, with the long centuries of the church's pilgrimage behind her, the hope of the present-day remnant of the priesthood shines brighter, and the pulse quickens as we realize that the glorious consummation of the type is at hand. And two, the presence of Joshua, type of the glorious Christ, suggests to us the presence of Christ during this harvest time, though the world knows it not. The priesthood is under a solemn exhortation, for they must stand until every jot and tittle of the events are finished. For the priests which bear the ark stood in the midst of Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord commanded. Understandably, antitypically, the priesthood must first finish their sacrifice in death before the life-giving fruits of Canaan in the new world can come to mankind. This exhortation is especially needed for the priesthood of the present hour, with antitypical Canaan's shores more clearly in view just before us. Canaan in this picture is not a type of heavenly, but of earthly conditions, where humanity will still have many battles, many trials and sorrows, ere the forces of evil shall have been fully subdued. Hence the antitypical priesthood is not to enter Canaan in the flesh, even as the typical priests were to have no inheritance in the land. Yet there is undoubtedly a powerful temptation that assaults the priests as they stand in the bed of Jordan supporting the ark. There is the temptation to leave the ark in the midst of Jordan and be ready to join the people rushing into the land with Jericho in the distance. Her impressive walls must have intrigued all who gazed upon them. Certainly there is much more adventure in exploring a new country with all its hidden fascinations than standing in the riverbed supporting the ark. There is much more fatigue involved in standing behind while countrymen run into the land that flows with milk and honey. Much more interesting is the prospect of getting into the promised land ahead of our fellows, especially ahead of those who stand behind in the muddy river bottom. There must have been a large measure of patience and self-control, as well as devotion to duty on the part of those priests who carry the ark in the midst of Jordan, enabling them to resist and reject such a temptation for earthly Canaan. What is the lesson in this for the antitypical priests of this present hour? Ah, they behold with the eye of faith a clear outline of the shores of the new earth, with all the knowledge of present truth acquired during the harvest concerning restitution, the millennium, and the reign of peace. Would they not be of great service to the throngs of humanity even now, who will soon pass over into the glorious land of restitution? Why wait? Why not bend all energy toward instructing the people now in taking away Satan's strongholds? Why not organize them now in battle array while there are enemies to be put away? Alas, ancient history has revealed that some have left what seemed to them to be either too momentous or else monotonous undertaking, sacrifice, and making the bride ready, that they might join in the more exciting project of leading the march of conquest to the New World Company along with the world. We are faced with both the anxiety of the returning floodwaters of the Jordan, which will mark the end of the priestly mission, as well as with patience to remain at our post. But the priests must remain faithful with the ark. Yes, the priests of this hour are to remain bound to their sacrificial task. And as some of their impatient fellow members who have already taken to other paths were to look back, they would observe some faithful priests still standing and carrying on the purpose and mission of the spiritual priesthood, remaining in the place of consecration unto death. There they stand, the last few remaining priests, with the testimony of the Apostle Paul engraved upon their hearts, "This one thing I do." To be sure, their hearts are also beating with keen anticipation at the things shortly to come to pass. but they have sacrificed everything. Even the pleasure of joining in the throng which pass over into the new shore, the new world. They will remain at the same post until death. Nor need the faithful priest standing in Jordan be terrified, lest these waters should return upon them and overwhelm them. In the type, the unfaltering faith of the priests, in the power of the ark, as the real cause of the miracle, set aside any fear or terror of the possibility of an impending catastrophe by reason of the waters breaking loose upon them as they stood in the riverbed, waiting for the people at large to cross to the other shore. And so it is with the antitypical priests. The curse of Adamic death sentence was permanently removed for the church by the death of Christ. The waters of Jordan for us are already rolled away. So far as the humanity of the antitypical priest is concerned, there can be no further hazard, for according to Romans chapter 6, verse 13, we are already reckoned dead according to the sinful flesh, but alive unto God through Christ. How can we be affected by the threat of a flood? Yet they are in a certain kind of jeopardy. For as new creatures they stand in Jordan's bottom, subject to the possible overwhelming waters of death. Their security is assured, however, so long as they remain steadfast till their release from the task, standing in Jordan, of supporting the ark. True, there may be times in the lives of each when discouragement and trials weigh down heavily upon them. Yet they are privileged to rely upon the divine assurance, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. Isaiah 43, verse 2. The ark, the sacred symbol of the covenant of God, of Christ, with his love, his grace, his power, will effectively keep his faithful children safe from the turbulent waters. What a picture of inspiration. God's purposes for the earth are bound up with the faithfulness of the antitypical priests. So long as the priests remain at their posts of consecration, of dying in sacrifice in Jordan, and carrying the will of God, the bearing of the ark, the waters of Jordan are held back, as they were by the typical priests in the days of Joshua. The symbol is not unlike Revelation chapter 7, with the winds held back until the servants are sealed in their foreheads. How long do we stand in Jordan? What fear need the antitypical priests have if it seems to be long? Death rides swiftly today over the high places of the earth. Violence and turbulence are appallingly widespread. Truly, it is more widespread than man has ever known. And the River Jordan, in its turbulent condition at the harvest time, may well bring to mind the fury of death in the earth today. But these things need not terrify the saints. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword? Romans 8, 35 to 39. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor heights, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. We think that the feet of the priests first touched Jordan waters in 1878. Those who are alive and remain stand in the midst of Jordan till everything is finished. According to the Lord's commandments, yes, theirs is a task that will be finished, never again to be resumed in all history. As the Savior invited his disciples to drink of his cup, yes, to drink all of it, so it is the one understanding that will come to a permanent end when that cup is finished. Nor can we allow anyone to distract us from our mission before the work is to be finished and the church joined with her Lord and head. To put down the ark, or to join the rushing multitude ahead, or join the militia, would be to abandon our first cause. The mission is to bear the covenant on our shoulders, and so allow the world to pass into the promised land. The mission is to bear testimony of the power of the plan, to deliver the race into the everlasting kingdom. Regarding the standing in Jordan, there is a work to be finished before Israel and the mixed multitude is fully delivered into the new order. This is the fullness of the Gentiles, the filling up that which is behind of the afflictions of Christ. The self-denial, the cross-bearing, the mortification of the flesh, the human will, and becoming conformed to the image of God's dear Son. And so, yes, the world is running from the wilderness, may not clearly understand what lies in the land just ahead of them. There may be some desire for a land of milk and honey, but also fear of ominous foes. Yet according to Romans 8, the whole world is groaning and waiting for the deliverance, the full redemption of the body of the priesthood. Yet the priests are still standing somewhat upstream in the middle of Jordan. The world is not very clear about their work or their message. Indeed, the gospel will be preached on a grander and more effective scale than ever before, when the pure language shall be turned toward the people, and the hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies. But then they will remember that there had been a voice, even one crying in the wilderness. The voice will then be the voice of singing and harps when they stand together on Mount Zion, Revelation 14, 2 and 3. Then they will remember the testimony and glorify our Father in heaven. Until then, the ark will remain on the shoulders of the high praises of God on our lips. This dramatic picture written for our admonition in Joshua might at first seem to imply that the world of mankind is therefore to receive some Canaan blessings or in some way life, even before the church crosses Jordan and receives her reward. This, of course, is not in harmony with our understanding of the scriptures, that life cannot be received until the church is complete. As we said before, we have various pictures of the closing aspects of the gospel age and of the world entering into Canaan. It must be remembered, however, that the world's reaching the other shore does not signify acquiring instantly the restitution blessings in the ultimate degree. The crossing of the world into Jordan will be but the first step requisite to receiving the blessings that will follow. God's hour will have struck in heaven with the final sacrifice of the priesthood. While it will mean the end of the sacrifice and therefore a judicial lifting of the curse of death, it will not mean a sudden establishment of a perfect kingdom of God and the world in all respects. So, in one sense, man has begun entering Canaan ever since Michael stood up, Daniel 12, or the seventh trumpet sounded and the kingdoms of this world became our Lord's, Revelation 11, and even more when Gentile crown was turned to its rightful owner. Because the times of restitution proceeds progressively. And all the time the priesthood have been standing in Jordan. They have not received life yet, but they are beginning to enter upon restitution. The world may first be at a loss to realize fully that Jordan is being crossed, or when it stands on the other shore in the new order, even as they come to realize that some phenomenal thing has happened. The healing beams of the Son of Righteousness will draw attention to the source of those rays. Christ in his glorious role as mediator of the new covenant will be revealed in the future. As for the priests, however, their crossing of Jordan will mark the time of their change and entrance upon their complete inheritance. Thus, while the world will only begin its conquest of the enemy strongholds in the new earth as pictured in the battles that follow in Canaan, the priesthood will have fought its last trial, will have overcome every opposition, will have finished its conquest of sin and self and Satan, and entered into their full spiritual reward. The last members of the priesthood standing in these days have an incredible privilege, for they parallel the ancient priests in Jordan. They are actually observing the marshaling of the peoples of this world as a prelude to crossing to the new earth of the millennial kingdom. The time is at hand. The restless masses of the people, the resounding of many voices, are but some of the manifestations of the eminence of that momentous event of which the antitypical priests have been in anticipation. So some of the world are entering restitution even while the priests are here, but life must await them until the priests are finished. There's another picture for the last mission of the church. Brother Russell has an article on reprint 3086 on the crossing into Canaan. It's a lesson that is from Joshua, the sixth chapter. Here he considers another aspect of the work of the priests in conjunction with the demise of the old order pictured by Jericho. Here is a separate lesson regarding our commission with the old kingdoms of this world and making way for the new kingdom. It is another lesson, but complementary to the standing of Jordan. Here is the lesson of vigilance. The city is encompassed, and we are the living witnesses of that city being surrounded. Joshua chapter 5, 13 to 15 records how Israel of God is able to prevail to possess the kingdom. I'd like to read those verses, Joshua 5, 13 to 15. And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went unto him and said unto him, art thou for us or for our adversaries? And he said, Nay. But as captain of the host of the Lord, I am now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth, and did worship, and said unto him, What saith my Lord unto his servant? And the captain of the Lord's host said unto Joshua, Loose thy shoes from off thy foot, for the place wherein thou standest is holy. And Joshua did so. Who is this celestial messenger? It is the same angel who was promised in Exodus 23, verses 20 to 23. It is the same angel who spoke to Moses from the burning bush in Exodus 3, 2 to 6, who also commanded Moses to return to remove his shoes, for he is on holy ground. There Moses stood before the one that is likely the Logos, who stood here also before Joshua and spoke with Joshua as he did with Moses. And Joshua asked this prince of the hosts of Jehovah if he is for Israel or for his adversaries. But the answer is strange. He says, Neither. Neither one. Not for us, nor for our adversaries. Why? The battle is the Lord's. It is not ours. That's the point. This is his battle. He is not fighting our battles. He is the general, the prince, the commander, the captain of the hosts of Jehovah. You see, Joshua asked the wrong question. Not whether the Lord is here to fight our battles, but the question should have been, if we are on his side, are we fighting his battles? Are we following him, marching with a greater commander? With this matter resolved, Joshua was able now to proceed resolutely against Jericho's walls. This was not Jericho's battle. It was the Lord's. So the angel said, I am not fighting your battles, nor your enemies. I will prevail. Are you on my side? And that's the question for us. The present evil world and the works that are therein are doomed to destruction and be swept away. In fact, Jericho was fully burned after it fell. New York City, a mighty city with their twin towers, fell to the winds of destroyers, and 2,700 people died in a few hours. America was horrified. But what about 500,000 Syrians who have been slaughtered and millions that have fled the country? Migrants are flooding Europe. Brother John reminded us of Somalia, those starving and oppressed infants and children. He reminded us of Jeremiah 25, verse 32. Iran vows to destroy Israel. Islam proposes to rule the world. But there's a mightier general. Financiers of the world are drowning in red ink of their own making. James chapter 5, 2 and 3. Their riches are corrupted, and garments are moth-eaten. Their gold and silver is cankered. Psalms 2, verse 1. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing. The world is still trying to outrun the tsunami and broken walls of Jericho. The priests are still carrying the ark and must not remove it from their shoulders. But in the picture, there are seven priests with trumpets and ram's horns bearing the ark. There are some personal lessons here as well. Is there a temptation to lay aside the trumpets, to cease our march around the city with the ark, or retreat from the jeers and ridicule coming from its walls? Our commission is to bear the covenant on our shoulders and also to sound the Jubilee trumpet. Only the priests have the work of sacrifice on their shoulders and the high praises of God on their lips, declaring into Zion, "Thy God reigneth." Only the priests know the implication of this message. Isaiah was commissioned in Isaiah 6, verse 10. "Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert and be healed." He then Isaiah asks, "But how long?" He is given the answer in verse 11, "Until the cities be wasted, without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate." Ours is a message that continues until the old order passes away. In this picture of Jericho, we ask, why seven priests with seven trumpets? Why not 12 for the 12 tribes? Why circle the city for 7 days? Why did the walls fall only on the last circle with the shout of all the people together? We cannot avoid the compelling similarity of Revelation 15 with the seven angels coming out of the temple to pour out the seven last plagues in chapter 16. Only with the seventh plague was the great city divided, and the cities of the nations fell, and every island fled away until the mountains were not found. And the battle is resolved on the seventh day, in the present Sabbath day. Are those seven priests leading the ark around Jericho the same seven who had the seven trumpets in Revelation chapters 8 and 9, and who are now leading the charge with the seven last plagues? Are they the same as the seven messengers who are now in glory with golden girdles? It should be noted that Jericho fell not with sword and spear, but with the shout of the people. The priests were not shouting, but the people were. The priests were blowing trumpets, and the people were shouting. There's something to learn here. Apostle Paul in Hebrews 11, verse 10, does not mention the shout. Hebrews 11, 10 says, "By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were compassed about 7 days." Oh, so it is by faith. Whose faith? The faith of the priests. The people followed. So, dear brethren, I'd like to conclude this lesson by walking back a little bit to those shores of Jordan, where those priests had been standing. There's one more lesson for the end times from Joshua chapter 4, verse 3, and verses 18 and 20. The priest stood in the midst of Jordan until the nation arrived on the other side. There are 12 stones, each of which were carried on the shoulders of a man selected from the 12 tribes of Israel. As they passed from their station, the Jordan waters flooded behind them. The death sentence is sealed. It is finished. The stones were picked up from the location of those standing priests and taken to the other shore to form a memorial of this miraculous passage, Joshua 4, 1 through 8. There were 12 who entered the water, chapter 3, verse 12, and 12 stones gathered, chapter 4, 3 and 5, where the priests had stood. So the number here is 12 for the tribes of Israel. The stones served the purpose to set a memorial, for they fittingly represent the stones themselves, 144,000 out of all the 12 tribes of Israel, who became dead with Christ according to the flesh. All this emphasizes our faithfulness unto death. Brother Russell does not identify a symbol for the 12. So we might just venture a possibility that the 12 that placed them were the prospective ancient worthies who foretold our day and time and the blessings to follow. They are picked up by the 12, the resurrected ancient worthies, and placed as a memorial of those called out of every nation, faithful unto death. As the memorial on the new shore, the significance doubles in that there will be an everlasting remembrance on the part of the redeemed in the ages to come. Never to be forgotten will be the goodness, the love, and mercy of God, which made it possible to have the curse of death lifted from the human race through the faithful office of the spiritual priesthood, the central figure which is the death of God's dear Son and a ransom for all. Joshua 4, 20-24. And those 12 stones which they took out of Jordan did Joshua pitch in Gilgal. And he spoke unto the children of Israel, saying, When your children shall ask their fathers in time to come, saying, What mean these stones? Then ye shall let your children know, saying, Israel came over this Jordan on dry land. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of Jordan from before you, until you were passed over, as the Lord your God did in the Red Sea, which he dried up from before us, until we were gone over, that all the people of the earth might know, all the people of the earth might know, the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, that ye might fear the Lord your God forever. Why were these stones placed as a memorial in Gilgal? Why not on the Jordan shore where they stepped out? Why not at Jericho where they led the victory? We might say, well, it was just where they camped the first night. Joshua 4, verse 3. But this little detail should not pass our attention. In Gilgal, they kept the Passover in the new land and drank a new cup. Joshua 5, verse 20. King David was welcomed by all Israel at Gilgal and began his procession to Jerusalem. 2 Samuel 19, verse 40. Years later, Elijah began his last earthly journey from Gilgal along with Elisha. Together they proceeded toward Jordan, and Elisha crossed in it, the other easterly direction, for the last time. And it was taken in a whirlwind and was seen no more. So here in Joshua, the 12 stones are simply left to mark the earthly side of the river for the sake of those who will remember. And we read from Isaiah 87, 5 through 7, from the English Standard Version. And of Zion it shall be said, this one and that one were born in her, for the Most High himself will establish her. The Lord speaks as he registers the people. This one was born there. Singers and dancers alike, all thy springs are in you. May it be said of you. May it be the portion of each of us to be blessed with a rich measure of such sustaining grace and strength, enabling us to hold fast our hope and our faithfulness until all be finished, until all be finished, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away.